Sunstone presents Mormon Marriage. Are the Rules Changing? Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
Of Mormon marriages, are the rules changing? I was thinking that the rules are changing just by trying to find a place that we don't have to split up couples here in the front. With all of the media attention to the changes in American marriage patterns over the last 20 years at least, if not more, I think it's only natural that we turn our focus to the same issues in Mormon marriages, and that is, are the rules changing? We've invited three couples to help us with that answer from their own experience, and each of these couples are willing not only to share their personal experience with how they've grappled with various rules in marriage as pertaining both to church issues as well as personal issues, but each one of them have had some experience, either professionally or otherwise, that would speak, I think, to the larger issues of things like two career couples, one person changing during the marriage, the other person not, those kinds of issues. Briefly, the format today will be that each couple will spend about 4 or 5 minutes introducing themselves and the theme of the changes or constancy that they have gone through. And then we will return to each one and have them spend about 10 to 12 minutes or so. I will be a tough moderator and say time, because we want to have plenty of time for discussion. We'll return and allow each one of them to discuss their topic or their particular area of focus more completely. After that, I will give just a brief context of research about what we know about Mormon couples over the last 30 years or so. I've reviewed some of that recently. And then we will like to ask you to question, and we will give you our current answers in process and continue in that way. To my extreme right is Lee White and Marilyn White. Next, we have Jill Mulvey-Durr and Brooke Durr, and Charlotte Hawkins England and Jean England. So I'd suggest we start in this direction and move.
Can you hear me all right now? Okay? All right? Charlotte and I started our marriage in very traditional ways, with the usual role expectations and I think the same family patterns that were just generally accepted in the church in the early 50s. We got married quite young. Charlotte was almost 20, as she says, and I was 20. And we gradually took on, I think, rather traditional roles. However, I think that was modified over time, maybe even immediately, by our personalities. Charlotte is a musician, fine musician and artist. I think that had some effect. I think we're both inclined to a sense of adventure, and that affected the way we approached our lives, our sense of the importance of learning, of life as a school. I was not, for instance, inclined to rather traditional views of vocation as connected with career. I was committed to the sense of vocation as sense of being to be found, not directly related to job necessarily, and my identity not so caught up with job as I think has been traditionally true of men, especially perhaps in the church in the 20th century. After about 10 years of marriage, we began to experience some difficulty, some real trouble. I think because we had accepted those roles rather unthinkingly and begun to fulfill them unthinkingly, and had not looked, especially I had not looked carefully enough at what the costs might be. And I think partly because Charlotte was more sensitive than I to those costs and felt the pain more directly, and that pain became unbearable in silence, we had to face them. And I think worked through, at that point in our marriage, a rather successful accommodation to the fact that we had set a course with rather traditional roles and would probably continue with that, but would have to make some real adjustments in the way we perceived them and the way we related to each other. I'll let Charlotte go from there.
Sounds like this is turning into true confessions. When Mary Beth said professional experience, I think the only thing I'm professional at is a wife at this point. I don't think I have much more to offer that, so this is all going to be kind of just from the personal experience. I think when she was asking us to express how we felt our expectations were different at the beginning of marriage and then after, I can't say that they were, because it was a very typical kind of thing where we were young, and I expected, I didn't really expect much different than what was happening. I just kind of went along and met things as they happened. So, and which is quite different than as I watch our children in their marriages, who really do discuss a lot of things, and probably discuss to the point of beating it to death some issues that I think maybe we were better off not discussing, because they kind of, you know, the problems would kind of go away by themselves if we allowed them to. But I was in school with Jean at the time, and we were both in school after marriage for a little while. But it I did expect, I mean, I just assumed that I went on being a housewife, a mother, and supporting Gene in what he was doing in school, in his profession or whatever. And that expectation did not change. So I'm probably coming from a little different angle than some of the others at this point.
I think Brooke and I are both certainly products of the 60s, the era in which we grew to maturity, and both of us came to our marriage with definite ideas about making a contract that we would share the roles of working and providing and nurturing. I, at the time we got married, was 29, and Brooke was 35. He was just finishing a divorce. Actually, it was about 6 months behind him, and coming into the marriage with three children, a son, 8, of whom he had custody, and daughters, 6 and 4, of whom he did not have custody. And so we started with a ready-made family. And as I say, the expectation that we could go forward in our in our work and nurturing, and that would be relatively simple. I don't know why we thought that. I think we were in love. seemed quite manageable at the time. Also, Brooke had moved to Utah from Monterey, where he'd been teaching at the Naval Postgraduate School, and moved to the University of Utah, where he was to spend a year visiting in the School of Education, and then moved to the School of Business. I had been with the Church Historical Department working with Leonard Arrington for about 5 years, and I thought that by cutting back to half-time, I would be able to manage Bentley, our son, and the new marriage. And it's been interesting to watch the last 9 years unfold. I think that I would characterize the first phase as this phase of optimism, that somehow we could share work and family life and it would go quite smoothly. I think the second phase would be facing the realities of that. And for one thing, because Brooke was starting at a new university, he needed to give a lot of time to his career. And there was another reason for that, too, and that's that he had cut back a lot on his work life during the years of the divorce to take care of the children and the painful personal things going on there. So he kind of speeded up his work involvement. I, on the other hand, cut mine back, as I say, by halftime, and learned about managing a household. To add to the complication, we both had work in Salt Lake City, and for some unknown reason decided to live 45 minutes away in Alpine. So we had a commute added to that, too. What happened in the second phase, I think, would be that while we started out with ideas that we could share everything, we moved gradually to a much more traditional model. And this became increasingly so as we entered a custody battle to get the two girls and finally succeeded in getting custody of them and then adding an additional two to our household plus a baby of our own. So my work that was half-time was cut back to quarter-time, and finally I decided to work freelance. And I think I was the person making most of the accommodation in, as I say, in a more traditional way. It was clear, for one thing, that as a freelance writer, I did not work quickly and could not bring in the income that we needed to sustain the family and legitimize Brooks being home more. Also, I found in myself, instinctively and from my own family patterns, that I enjoyed being home and I felt a great responsibility for caring for the children. So I think our second phase is becoming increasingly more traditional, and my backing off my career somewhat, which caused a lot of pain and conflict, that I think is getting resolved now in phase three, as we have comfortably accommodated to four children in the home and have our youngest in second grade, and we're able to work out a little more of a balance for both of us because Brooke is established professionally and the family is more established. So we're really in some ways back to where we started from.
Lee and I have been married for 13 years. It was a first marriage for both of us, and we have three daughters, ages 11, 9, and 6. I also grew up in a fairly traditional but somewhat transitory home. In order to move ahead in the oil company where my father was employed in the 50s and 60s, one moved with the company. And we transferred 10 times in my first 17 years of life, including shifts to three different high schools, one in Houston, Texas, one in Bountiful, Utah, and moved just before my senior year to Kansas City, Missouri, back to Jackson County. My mother was a court reporter before marriage, but stayed at home when her three children were born and was active in the LDS church in the community. My father, on the other hand, is a concerned, pragmatic, good father who traveled extensively and is a workaholic. One year, it was easier for my mother to count the days that he was home that year, which totaled 30 days out of the 365. He was a non-attender at church because he wasn't home too much, but he did go to occasional daddy-daughter parties and a few Easter Sundays. So my mother and the church were strong influences for good, and I even turned down a full-ride four-year scholarship in Missouri to take a partial two-semester scholarship at BYU. I lasted three semesters at BYU before taking a secretarial job in Salt Lake City in order to establish residency to attend the University of Utah. In the meantime, the Cinderella complex had carefully been, which had carefully been nurtured, blossomed when I met my Prince Charming and magnanimously consented to work after marriage to help Lee through graduate school, or through his undergraduate work. We both felt it was more important for him to get through school with the understanding that my turn to return to college would come later in life. When our first daughter was born, there was no question that I would quit work, even though Lee still had 2 years of graduate school left. It was during these 2 years that the economic realities of life became apparent, and I finally convinced Lee that an IBM Selectric typewriter in my home could turn into a profitable venture and pay for itself within a few months. Lee wasn't convinced that the clientele would be steady, but I spent the next 7 years building a part-time secretarial service in our home, typing numerous theses and dissertations and business and legal documents. It was during this time that I worked occasionally for Jack Newell at the University of Utah. He introduced me to his wife, Linda, who was just starting research on Emma Smith. We developed a lasting personal and business relationship that culminated in the typing and proofreading of her book, Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith. When our youngest daughter turned 4, I eased into an ideal secretarial job-sharing situation at a chemical company. When the boss decided he didn't like job-sharing anymore, I was offered employment as the secretary to Jim Kimball, president of Kimball Travel Consultants. I thoroughly enjoy the work with Jim and have been given some responsibility for certain small traveling groups. And in order to spend more time at home, Jim has allowed me to work 5 to 6 hours per day. I affectionately call it my jobette. Now, this is my favorite term because it is part-time and a relatively low-stress job. It is also a predominantly female profession. Many women, like myself, enjoy having jobettes. And many men also like their wives to have non-threatening jobettes. So, at least for now... we are constantly juggling priorities of church work, family, careers, and jobettes in an increasingly hectic environment. Now my present dilemma is saving enough money for college when the travel benefits I'm entitled to are so enticing.
Marilyn had mentioned that she was talking to a friend out in the hall before we began this session, and the person read that I work for the American Association of Retired Persons and assumed that we would be an older couple. I just want to say that I think the fact that I'm 75 should be adequate testimony that the association has plenty of things to offer, and for those of you over 50, I'd be happy to talk with you out in the hall after our session. I think I came into my marital relationship having inherited quite a bit more excess baggage than Marilyn brought into our relationship. I came from a very traditional Mormon home. I think if there are rules that are established in the Mormon church, my parents tried very, very hard to comply with those rules and regulations and doctrines that taught them how to be good Latter-day Saint parents. My mother and father had 9 children. My mother stayed home to protect the family from being destroyed as much as she did to provide a stable environment for the kids. And I say that in a very literal sense. It was chaotic most of the time, but I think it was also a very loving environment and provided a very good sense of stability for myself and my 8 brothers and sisters. My father was a bishop of our Bountiful Ward for 8 years, and at that time it involved about a 30 or 40 hour week of church work. I remembered my parents fighting one time in my growing up life, and I'm serious about that. And it was over the very substantive issue of what time we would leave for a vacation. And so I think you can get a sense of the type of environment in which I was raised. I came out of that environment with some very biased perspectives and expectations of what marriage should represent for me. The first of which was Father Always Knows Best, and I honestly had an image of Robert Young very benevolently raising the family and guiding the gracious but somewhat dingy wife through a series of relationships and behavioral expectations. Another one was no success can compensate for arguing in the home, and that, of course, tied in with rule number 1, Father Knows Best. Another rule that I expected was that a woman who wants to work professionally outside the home is either losing her natural affection for the family or her testimony. And for the mother trains and teaches the kids, and the father disciplines and has fun with the kids. These were really very rigid expectations that I carried into my marital relationship. As Marilyn mentioned, we were married in 1973, in December of 73, as a matter of fact, and by March of 74, I had a very clear understanding that rules 1 and 2 were inaccurate, and I had a suspicious message coming through that 3 and 4 were definitely in trouble. So I had to learn very early in our marriage that I had not married a woman who had the same attitudes and expectations of marriage that my mother had. I was also not the same type of person that my father was, and so we began really reviewing our marriage as a process where we defined as we went the good that emerged from our parents' relationships, the good that emerged from the rules that had been given to us from the larger organizational structure of the church, and are continuing in that process.
Since the panel voted that I should give my remarks from time to time, I'll introduce myself also briefly. I also grew up in a very traditional Mormon home and believed many of the rules that Lee just enunciated, and recall expecting that for my entire life in Prince Charming and all the rest and so on, and recall very clearly a time, it's one of those click experiences that happen in life, of sitting as a junior at BYU in a family relations class. And the instructor, Joel Moss, passed out a questionnaire that said, "Do you believe that husband or wife should do these various things or decide?" And there was this list. And this list had husband or wife doing diapers, cooking, all those other kinds of things. And, you know, even though I had seen my father do plenty of housework and changing diapers, it really had never clicked before then that that really was a choice. And since I knew I had a choice, my whole reality changed. ever since then. However, my dreams remain pretty much the same. Somehow I assumed that I could have ultimate choice and yet still all of the projected reality of traditional marriage, and it never occurred to me that those probably could come into conflict until after I was married. And then it came into full conflict. In fact, remained in full conflict, and I divorced 8 years after my first marriage. I remained a single parent for the next 6 or 7 years, and then remarried 3 years ago, and have continued that dialogue with my husband. And he came from a very traditional stance himself and lived, in fact, in a very long traditional marriage before that marriage ended. So we are continuing that dialogue among ourselves, and one that we're currently stuck on is housework, but we have gone to other issues and have gotten them resolved. Probably in terms of the work experience, once I started working, I knew that that was for me and that I would never stop working. And one important definition, I think, for couples, particularly in the Mormon world as well as in the world at large, is does the wife have a job or a career? And that makes all the difference for how they define their marriage. And that will then really affect whether the rules change or not, or whether they assume they have a choice over changing the rules or not. So that brief introduction on my part, I would like to go back to each one of the couples and have you discuss more in depth some changes, some areas of focus, and I'm leaving that totally up to them.
I mentioned the pain that we experienced together after about 10 years of our marriage. We were married in 1953, and implied that experience of working that through helped us a lot, and I think it did, but it didn't certainly solve all of our problems. Mm-hmm. I went on essentially making the decisions about where we would live, and Charlotte essentially adjusting to my career. And yet, I think that because of, again, individual personalities and interests that we shared and had uniquely, our marriage was unusual in some ways. For one thing, because of, I think, some inexpensive tastes and willingness to accept a somewhat lower standard of living and some help from our parents, Charlotte did not have to work. And I think that is a kind of thing that many couples face today in a new way. It might have been better if she had. I don't know. One of the things we're trying to work through is what that role of work in relation to identity is. I think one of my problems is I continue to be a subject to habit, and although there was a good deal of theoretical dismissal of the world and its rewards, I was very much involved in them and the satisfactions that come from them. I think partly as a result of that, I tended to be absent, not so much physically, but spiritually from the home. Rather recently, and Charlotte will want to talk about this, she did launch out with her own business, an ice cream business, as some of you know about, which had mixed success, great ice cream. We stopped on kind of a downbeat in the business, but mainly for the reason that we went to England together because of my career, and she's not started that up again, and she may want to talk about some of her feelings about that. Recently, some new pain has surfaced that we're trying to deal with our children. It's not easy. I find myself very much on the defensive and facing some very telling criticism that is difficult to look at, honestly. I couldn't help thinking that monogamy is very difficult. I defended it this morning, but I'd like to read to you some marginal notes from a friend of mine who, in reading my paper and where I lay out some of the ways we can violate that perfect monogamous fidelity by promiscuity, by self-gratification, masturbation that is selfish, homosexuality, lying to each other, not sharing fully and often our deepest feelings and hopes, refusing to be vulnerable, thus walling off parts of ourselves by not working constantly to justify and build complete trust. He adds in the margin, you might include passivity, lack of generosity, excessive focus on genital gratification, orgasmic goal-seeking, etc., etc. So many ways to get it wrong, even casual distraction, petty irritation, excessive solemnity or sobriety. It's a wonder anyone gets it right, ever. I think he's dead right. In fact, I confess I was a little bit tempted during the sessions yesterday on homosexuality to stand up and say, even with all the terrible, cruel problems that that our society imposes on homosexuals, and even the cruelty of AIDS, I think it may be easier than monogamy. It just is so easy to get it wrong. It's so often easy to let it drift into superficiality or distractions. I think the role battles can be a distraction and changes. Let me just add one thing. I can't help giving advice at my age, and this is a kind of advice in response to the questions that were raised for us in the panel about how roles are changing. I guess I feel that they are, but not in some of the ways we might have expected. They're certainly changing in theory. We certainly think about roles differently than we did in my parents' generation, or certainly than we did early in our marriage. I don't think they're changing quite that much in practice, and in fact there may be some turning back to them for some reasons that have already been suggested. And that may not be necessary to change them in practice very much, if we can get over some of the assumptions, the sexism about them, accept them together as responsibilities that might best be handled in rather traditional ways, away from social pressures but through individual choice. But I think we need to look at some more basic things about what may be changing because of changes in our society, including changes in our sense of sex roles. Just one example. Let me read to you from President Benson last spring. President Benson emphasized the need, this was at BYU, President Benson emphasized the need for a strong family unit. There are many forces pulling at the fabric of family life, he said. A happy marriage is based on family worship. Now, that sounds awfully simple and even simplistic, but the key is family worship. You know, we've heard that before. But I guess I'm coming to feel more and more that that's right. And if some of you have trouble accepting President Benson's word on this, let me read from an article I clipped out of the page of the paper the same day, a speech given almost at the same hour, coincidentally, by Mother Teresa in San Jose, California. Love begins at home, she said. By praying together, members of a family can make the joy of love grow among themselves, she said. Fingering her rosary beads, this was before an audience of about 3,000 people. Fingering her rosary beads, she asked the audience to pray for parents who want their children, and urged them to bring their family by praying together. There is so much suffering in the world today, so much loneliness, so much throwaway of society, so much big, big pain in so many hearts. She elaborated on the reference to people rejected through the sin of AIDS by talking about the 15-bed home that her order opened for AIDS victims in Manhattan last Christmas. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think one of the dangers that I see my children facing as they marry and try to work out their relationships, and that impinge on Charlotte and me as we try to recreate our relationship, is that we can get preoccupied with lesser matters. It's very easy to let TV, the centripetal forces that are increasing in our society, various interests, issues, lead us to neglect very basic things in the family, including family worship, individual worship, piety, church service, and worship. And I guess I'm suggesting that maybe we can, like T.S. Eliot suggested, return to our beginning place and really see it for what it is. That is, maybe we can return to some rather traditional models by choice with some flexibility, where both of us, men and women, man and woman, realize that the most important work we will ever do is in our own home, and really feel that and act accordingly. Both of us realize that we are in this life in school, in an eternal school, educating ourselves for eternity. Both of us realize that the children and accept the responsibility for helping them come to a sense of both being nurtured and achieving autonomy.
I'm going to back up a little bit and tell you, in order for you to understand the change in my role from the time we were first married to this experience with the ice cream shop, I'm going to tell you a little bit about our courtship and early marriage. Gene and I got to know each other quite well because I was dating his best friend. And we used to double date all the time. And Gene would do these kind of off-the-wall things and kind of crazy. And the girls would come and say, I don't understand, Gene. Why does he do this and that? So I'd explain to them, you know, well, it's because he's this and this and this. And, you know, not realizing that someday I would be dealing with that. So we knew each other well before we dated. In fact, when he called me up on a date the first time, I was so flabbergasted, I think, and I probably giggled and talked too much and too fast and everything. I think he was just about to call me back and cancel the date because, you know, this was not the person he had known all this time. But we had a great time. And we courted that year and married. And then we went on a... 6 months after we were married, we were sent to Samoa on a mission. And I don't think this is too typical. And this was totally to our surprise. We had not planned this. We hadn't anticipated anything. We were expecting Gene to go on a mission after we were married because this was during the Korean War when the draft board was not allowing the church to send missionaries out like they were. And so I was anticipating staying home, going to school, working, or possibly going on a short mission while he finished up his. Well, we both received our calls to Samoa. We had to go look it up in a map at the University of Utah and find out what they had. We found out they had a few cows and horses and lots of pigs. And I mean, we didn't know what we were getting into. We were young, but ready for anything. And our lives have been pretty much that way. We've taken on adventures and things that if we really sat down and thought about it and talked it over, we would never have done them. And so there's a certain spontaneity in that I really cherish in our marriage. It has brought us experiences that we would not have had and that our children wouldn't have had, and I think we wouldn't have grown near as much, as hard as it was during all those things, had we not been open to new adventures. And so by the time, but I went on being this, you know, very traditional housewife, trying to squeeze in a little music and art once in a while, but finding it very difficult to do. By the time I was 50, I had discovered that there was something that maybe I could do that was marketable. And I happened to be a very good cook. And I grew up with my mother making ice cream, and we'd make fresh apricot ice cream off our apricot tree, and I just thought, why not make ice cream? So at the time, there was a development going on in Provo that some people heard about me just experimenting with ice cream. I didn't think I was going to be doing it then, but they, with a little encouragement and with my total lack of business skills and knowledge, I went into it. And it was an immediate hit, but as things didn't develop down there, and if you know what business is like in Provo, then Gene's opportunity to go to England came up, and I closed the shop. And as I've looked back over that, this only happened in 81, and in 84. And I haven't quite figured out why, but it's still a very emotional thing for me. And as soon as I bring up the idea that I would take all my equipment out of storage and possibly start it up again, my children en masse, together, jointly, jump on me and almost kill me. Because I just about, you know, I mean, I burned out with it. They, and some of them did too. It brought a lot of strife to our home. I had envisioned, you know, this wonderful family business and everybody jumping in and doing it together. And what a fun thing that would be. Well, I could write a book on what I don't know about business and probably make a lot of money on it. But I think the thing that tears at me is that it was the one thing I did in my life where I used my agency, and I didn't realize, you know, I think for a long time that there was free agency in marriage, and that I could really do something on my own, and that was my own expression of something I could do. So I learned a very painful, through a very painful way, what that entailed, and what I was finally unwilling to do was to sacrifice all that it would take for Gene, for my children, and for my father who lives with us, who's 92. I found myself juggling so many different things that I thought, you know, is this really what life's all about? And I do have a choice in this. And I did choose to close it. Not easily. But that's where, I mean, I did really see a change in my position. And one thing that I learned from it was I gained some self-confidence that I didn't know that I could do something like that. So it was another adventure that, as painful as it was, I'm glad I went through it.
I think the theme that Joe and I are trying to talk to today is how to fine-tune and question this dual career model and make it work for us. That assumes that there is a dual career model, since most of the researchers aren't sure about that, as a whole generation of people tries to grope and feel their way and come to terms with two people working in a household. Some issues, though, that have been important to us, and Jill talked about us having different phases, that I thought I might comment on because they both have a conceptual thrust to them and also are personal. First of all, I just think male-female differences have been very important in the sense that my experience is that growing up in my childhood in a little rural town in southeastern Idaho was very powerful medicine. And strangely enough, my sense in looking back at it is that the the family was essentially a matriarchy, with the women making a lot of the very most fundamental decisions. And one of those was that the men dug on it out of work, get out there in the fields and work their tails off, and if they do a good enough job, they can go fishing one day a year, but they better be home to milk the cows. So I was, another message that I really picked up was my son the doctor, my son the lawyer, my son the so-and-so that lives up on the hill with a big house. And there were just a lot of messages that came through and that I somehow picked up on, and went on to do fairly well in college and get my degrees and my tickets punched. And I think that the process of doing that really had you know, divorces are so difficult because there's so many factors involved, but it really had an impact on my first marriage. And I remember being left in that marriage in a kind of Kramer versus Kramer way, not quite as dramatic, and being a single parent of three small children for a period of time. And that was a real turning point for me, as I started to really question what I'd been about and how I could live my life a little bit differently. But why I think the male-female differences are important is that if I think of myself, I think that of myself as a very supportive husband and father who has made a real generational transition. And I've been part of an LDS male support group, a Mormon men's group, for 4 or 5 years that we've been going. or three or four, whatever it's been. And I think that most of us there have a career-oriented wives, and most of us would think of ourselves that way. But if you ask the wives, I think they would probably say that, you know, they do the lion's share of the work, and I'm sure they do, and that they that we don't take any real responsibility for the home. We don't think about it. We don't do those sorts of things. And I remember a discussion we had in the men's group one night where we said, gee, I mean, you know, we've made a quantum jump. I mean, from our own reference group and from our father's generation, and our wives are saying these kinds of things. It's really unfair. And besides, what bugs us is no matter how much money they're making, they don't take responsibility for the finances. And so I don't know to what extent these things are just very deeply ingrained, at least in my generation, to what extent they're almost primeval, the kind of providing hunter role versus the nurturing role. And I think that I feel part of a group of people who've made a real attempt, a group of men, but I'm not sure how far we've really come. I'm certainly willing to adjust the intensity of my career. The thought of doing something really risky like Jill has been willing to do is just so frightening, so incredible to me that I just can't even imagine it. So I'm willing to cut back to be more balanced. I'm not willing to change careers. I'm not willing to not be a career-oriented person. I'm not willing to give up all of those things that are just so incredibly ingrained in me as essential to my being a Mormon male. And I say Mormon there because I think we live in a very high-achieving culture. When I went to Harvard, I worked on the Achievement Motivation Project and walked in, and David McClellan said, "Oh, you're a Mormon. Well, that's good, because Mormons and Jews just go off my chart here on achievement." So, anyway, so I don't. I'm trying to sort some of that out, and I'll get to that point in just a second. But I don't know where to go with that. The second issue I think for us in this fine tuning has been, in fact, the unrelenting pressure of organizations, of tickets to be punched, of things to do, of external demands, so that we could have viable careers, and could in fact make the money that it takes to make the thing go, and make the and have somebody who's delivering what it takes to make things happen. And I see us moving into a less humanistic period, not a more humanistic period. I see organizations being less willing to negotiate, to be flexible. We had high hopes in the women's movement and with EEO and the government and other things that this would change, but I don't see that happening. I think we're in a period of competing with the Japanese and the Koreans, and I think that the job market is such with the labor glut that it's just, you know, tough, hard, competitive environment, and all forces forward. And I think it's very difficult in that sense to carve out for yourself the kind of flexible career which many of us would like. The third issue for me is just a life stage, career stage kind of issue, because Jill will talk about this in a minute, but last year we spent a year in France, and that had a big impact on us, and I now for the first time feel myself wanting to not slough off or gear down, but deal with relaxing and hobbies and friendships and more time with my kids and health issues, and for the first time find myself questioning what role, what I want to do in this work life. I mean, sort of how I want to focus. Mornings at 3 and 4 o'clock, I can get up to actually write anymore. Sort of trying to sort of put this into some perspective. And again, the unrelenting pressure of organizations is an important one, because I don't know how many of you have read the paper, but the university and other places, they want more for less. And in some ways, they have a right to ask for that. But those things are in conflict, and our personal situation is such that it's a very expensive time. Kids look forward to colleges and missions, and I don't know how many of you have priced small liberal arts colleges lately, but most of them start at $8,000 and end at $15,000. And as we think of trying to manage this thing, I could see myself for the first time cutting back to half time. But it doesn't look in the cards. It doesn't look at all possible. So just by way of concluding and then letting Jill make a few comments, I think that we're in the third phase where we're trying to work out the best work relationship kind of mix, or personal life versus professional life mix, in a period of life where the externals look complex and yet we're moving internally in a little different direction. And I think on the one hand it's helpful because we're communicating about that and we're feeling these things. On the other hand, it looks very, very difficult to manage. And so we're just, like most dual career couples, going along by our bootstrings, trying to get out the schedule book every Sunday night and make it from week to week.
We lived in France for 8 months, from January to July of 1985. And our being there, I think, had a great impact on our marriage and on our family life. For one thing, because of the pressures that I felt in my work, the commitments I'd made, and the work in the family, I feel like I literally ran to the plane. Well, I did. as you might guess, I was up all night the night before and got on the plane, and it took off, and I just thought, I am so glad to leave all of that behind, all of that confusion, all of that mess and pressure and commitments, and maybe I can get away and just think for a while and get things straightened around. I think one of the things that struck me as soon as we got to France, my not having been there before, although Brooke served a mission there, was the incredible importance of relating. I remember the first few days Brooke explaining to us the kind of conversation that we needed to carry on in the shops, the words that we needed to say, not to offend our shopkeepers. And in fact, the man that kept the bread shop and the cheese shop and the candy shop and all of those people became very important to us. So it was good that we knew how to converse with them and how to relate to them. And I think this emphasis on relationships characterized for us the French culture. Now, I realize that our perspective was skewed. We were there for a short amount of time. We saw a limited number of people. But our impression of France, I think, was that relationships were incredibly important, both the casual ones, like I've mentioned, and those with friends. We went to church the first Sunday, and after staying for 15 minutes to chat, we realized we were the first to leave. So the next week we stayed for 30 minutes and realized we were still the first to leave. The next week we stayed for an hour and realized we were still the first to leave. these were really people who loved to talk to each other, and we never went to a dinner that lasted under 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours. And these were things that took some time to get accustomed to, but I came to love it. I came to love the blocks of time for relating to people. In this culture, for us, we could see it was clearly legitimate to block out large periods of time for marriage, for family, for friends, and people didn't apologize for that or hurry off. In the church, you know, the first Sunday we went, Brooke was called into the branch presidency, and the branch president was saying he would like to be excused for 2 weeks because he and his wife were tired and needed the time off. And he was sure things could go on fine without him, and they did. And all last summer, the elders' quorum president was excused from his duties because people understood that it was a high-pressure time in his life, and what time he had would have to go to his family, and that was okay. My sense was that in that society, performance was not what counted. And it was nice to have that pressure off and have a chance to think of the other things that count. At the same time, when I first went, I was reading Carol Gilligan's book about In a Different Voice, and looking at the way that women prize relationships and affiliations. At the same time, I found myself really plunged into the family relationship, since our family drew close together, as we didn't have soccer teams and gymnastics and mutual and school activities. We were really with each other every night, and I really came to value and love that time. Brooke and I took much more time for each other. Our dates were not an hour or 2 hours. They were day long. And Paris was a wonderful place to fall in love again. Not that we'd fallen out of love, but we realized how much more in love we could be. I just found this really refreshing. I felt like when I came home from France, I looked younger, I felt younger. I really felt like I could take the world on. But coming back was really difficult. I think we had come to prize this relating time with each other and with our family, and we had assumed that we could just make it work in American culture and not being on sabbatical. And we found that that was extremely difficult. We just plunged right back into the hot water and felt the pressures. And after 4 months, both of us went into extensive therapy separately. But it was good. I think we've both worked on things to come to terms with the fact that we really value some things that aren't valued in our culture. We really value cutting out some big blocks of time for our family and for each other. And we've both needed to come to terms with changing some of our some of the expectations we've brought with us from our families, some of the patterns we've brought with us from our families, and the ability to say no to a lot of things. And tying back to what Jean said in conclusion, I think that what I've come to see is that to make a marriage work, to make a family work, it cannot be just what fits in when the work is done. It's not enough to run home and do the dishes or clean the house or taxi the kids where they need to go. It's not enough to talk to Brooke just before we fall asleep. That it really takes an enormous commitment and an enormous amount of work, not only in time, but it also takes letting go of some of the things that are dear to me. I've had to give up being a perfectionist, and that has been very painful. That's been a painful giving up. I've had to learn to make commitments with a full consciousness of what that will mean for my marriage and my family. And I've had to learn not to close off my emotions, even though it is more painful to be vulnerable. I've had to learn to keep them open, and as Jean mentioned, not to get bogged down in the logistics. And I've had to learn to be a little bit at odds with American society, because their efficiency is the value. And for me, I have come to realize that efficiency is not the primary value. I see the beauty and the value of relating, and it's something to which I want to devote a great deal of my time and my energy. And at this point, it is getting most of my energy, and yet I find that even with that, my work can still be satisfying.
The next part of our remarks, we were asked to focus upon the internal and emotional aspects of our marriage, which is basically what we have all done. And this task immediately conjured up questions to me of how is a Mormon marriage different from a non-Mormon marriage? How do we manage conflict differently than we used to? Have the rituals changed? What has happened to our friendships over the years? How has the spiritual and emotional core of our marriage been nurtured? And how does the institution impact on that marriage? And what do I perceive is in the future for Mormon marriages? Now, it was with much trepidation that I approached these and other questions, and I will not attempt to answer them all, but it was a hard process for me to go through. I was traumatized by it in some ways. But unfortunately, all of the thoughts that I originally formulated in answering these questions seemed to deteriorate into kind of preachy, advice-giving, pat-myself-on-the-back type of scenarios, very much akin to what I think I sometimes read in the How We Did It section of the Church News. So anyway, the question that appealed to me most were related to philosophical changes that inevitably take place to a small or great degree in, over a period of time that would influence a marriage. And I have seen the marriages of some friends retrogress or even fail as one spouse or the other shifts belief systems until the incongruency negatively impacts this ever-elusive marital bliss. I feel fortunate that Lee and I usually agree philosophically on significant issues, because there was a time in my life when a slight diversion did occur for me. I went through a period of what I will call feminist consciousness raising, and I hate buzzwords like that, but for lack of anything better, that's what I decided to stick with, and I think this does put a picture in our minds that many can relate to. It was a time of having two women show up on my doorstep to discuss Mormons for ERA, and I think they were even referred to as missionaries. I remember seeing a woman in my ward wearing a Mormons for ERA badge on her blazer at sacrament meeting and wanting to get to know her better. Sonia Johnson became a focal point, but most seemed apathetic and quick to judge. It was also refreshing to watch my own mother redefine some of her roles as she became more aware of current feminist literature. One night in particular, I was down in my basement cubicle until the wee hours of the morning typing Linda Newell's excellent essay, Gifts of the Spirit, Women Share, that eventually was condensed for Sunstone and won, I think, best article of the year in MHA. A great sadness welled up inside of me as I contemplated the institutional policy shifts that seemed to take great responsibility away from present-day Mormon women. The next morning, I debriefed with Linda on the phone for a while, but more importantly, was anxious to have Lee read the paper. It was a rather pivotal moment in our marriage for me when Lee empathized with my pain and we came to grips with a philosophical resolution that worked for us. Now, it has also been energizing in our marriage to write letters jointly or individually to general authorities or auxiliary presidents when various issues are of concern to us or even when we feel thanks are deserved. Now, I noticed that Jim Kimball, my boss, walked in the room, and I hesitate to say this because I'll never hear the end of it, but lunch is generally the high point of my downtown day, and it's been a real boost, and I speak of this in relation to our marriage because Lee and I are able to meet at least once or twice a week to have lunch. We have spirited discussions about current events, politics, ward events, or children as a juicy Big H or Crown Burger is ingested with gusto. But it has been a comfortable, healthy feeling to have such compatibility in a marital relationship and watch it mellow and mature over the last decade. And as in most marriages, we too have had our moments of crisis that I know have been eased by our Mormonness and a faith in a greater power. I will quickly condense what can be a very long story. I have always been a healthy person, and until I was 31 years old, had never been admitted to a hospital except to bear children. But in late 1983 and early 1984, the yin and yang in our marriage went a little bit out of control. Our aging Subaru station wagon threw a rod going down Parley's Canyon, and repairs totaled over $2,000, but it was cheaper than a new car. Lee had a bitter rejection on an employment opportunity after months of not thinking that he was going to get the job and then being finally rejected. I was unexpectedly let go in my job-sharing situation, and as frosting on the cake, I had two major but different illnesses within a month and a half of each other. The first was the very unusual sensation of having the right half of my face go numb, and when it didn't go away by the fifth day, I saw a neurologist. Now, I learned very quickly that a neurologist cannot be considered your everyday, run-of-the-mill type of doctor, because it is very rare that you have a doctor say, you may have one of four things: a brain tumor, an aneurysm, multiple sclerosis, or something undefinable. But my guess is that you have MS. Then a few weeks later, on the night before my 31st birthday, I became very ill with abdominal pain. I was in the hospital for 3 days getting IVs and a shot of Demerol every few hours before they finally decided on surgery. The doctors discovered I had been suffering for those 3 days with a ruptured appendix. The 7 days in the hospital has appropriately been recorded in my Treasures of Truth book under the heading Most Memorable Birthdays. So I was a very idealistic 20-year-old when we first married, and I believe that if the above experiences had happened earlier in the marriage, I may well have made the following conclusions. 1, God was testing me. And 2, I possibly deserved what was happening. I was lucky to have a few years of marriage under the belt and maybe some maturity and a comforting surprise of the Spirit that impacted our marriage greatly. Instead of buying into the above rules at face value, I instead emerged feeling these more comprehensive and qualifying beliefs. 1, a sense of humor and perspective is vital to the emotional health of our marriage. 2, God does not grant us life with a full script from start to finish. We are bound by the physical limitations and imperfections of mortality, which we chose to accept before we came. And 3, my appreciation for life is heightened to a greater degree, which seems common in people who have been in life-threatening situations. I seem to value time with friends and family more, and at times gratitude for pain-free days can still bring on tears of joy. I struggle now with maintaining that heightened sense of appreciation and taking improved health for granted. And four, a deeper faith in priesthood power also emerged. The surprise of the spirit I referred to earlier had to do with a priesthood blessing that Lee gave me after first seeing the neurologist. I was extremely tired that night and more than a bit upset with the probable diagnosis. I consented to the blessing, but frankly had some pent-up anxiety regarding exactly what the priesthood is. I questioned how it was different from basic faith and how I, as a woman, interacted with it. I often become agitated over certain rhetorical and sometimes unanswerable dilemmas, and this was just one in a field of many. But I didn't think my questions regarding priesthood had answers in this mortal life. But I delightfully received some surprising solace in my quandary simply by a joint form of communication that took place during that blessing. It gave me a sense of participation in the priesthood that I had never felt before and has become the most religiously bonding experience so far in our marriage. So in the final analysis, my conclusions about crisis in marriage are not particularly original, and I won't be submitting them to how we did it. But that crisis did deeply internalize some Mormon tenets, and I decided it is only through personal experience that we define the meaning of our life and of our marriage. Each person experiences the marriage differently, and we interpret our experiences differently, but it is that interpretation which strengthens our individuality and defines our very being. Hopefully, some universal threads have been woven through this subjective interpretation of those experiences and maybe touched a responsive chord of commonality. Thank you.
I think Marilyn described very well the great degree of ambivalence and dialogue we've had the last couple of weeks as we have faced this assignment. I have struggled in just identifying what roles and what rules existed for us when we were first married and how our relationship has changed where we are right now in comparison with where we were when we first got married. And in analyzing that, I think one of the major areas where I have personally changed is in the way in which I resolve conflict, in the way in which we address problems as a married couple, and in the way in which we try to come to definable, concrete solutions that will aid us in directing our lives. I go back to my introductory comments when I mentioned that I came from a home where there was very little apparent conscious conflict. I mentioned that my mother and father had one argument that I could remember. I carried this expectation into my relationship and thought that I not only had the fine successful example of my parents, but I had divine backing in my assumption that it was the male role to lead out and to provide a solution for any conflict that may have occurred. Marilyn came from an environment where there was much spirited discussion and a great degree of dialogue and involvement with just about any issue you could define. And putting those two types of environments together created a very interesting way of trying to resolve conflict in the beginning years of our relationship. I felt that it was not only my responsibility, but my patriarchal prerogative to try and listen to her and then come to a point where I would say, all right, I am speaking, you listen, there is no more argument or debate about this particular issue. And I expected her to fall into line. It was very, very disconcerting for me for her to say, the argument isn't over. What are you talking about? And instead of being able to face that rationally and continue the debate or realize that there may not have been a resolution to that particular issue, I would occasionally storm very petulantly out of the home and angrily bear this grudge that I think Gene expressed very eloquently in his comments for sometimes several days. And I don't want you to assume that the relationship we had at the beginning of our marriage was bad. We were very good friends, continue to be very good friends, but on those occasions when we would debate various issues, she was more rational than I was, and that irritated me. I didn't want her to be that way. I've embellished that particular part of our relationship for effect, but it was a very real and often painful experience for me to not have her bow her head and say yes, if you will, and knuckle under and observe what I wanted her to observe. Over the years, our way of resolving conflict has obviously changed, and I think has come to represent a much healthier way of reconciling problems. While I have been able to let go of my need to be right all of the time, I think Marilyn has learned how to appreciate my coming from a background where my folks never fought about anything, they never argued about anything, and realized how that would really touch buttons in my mind and really set up all kinds of strange reactions. When she wanted to get into a very spirited discussion, and I thought she was just trying to create a major confrontation in our lives. I've come to appreciate that any issue is open to discussion, especially if it falls into a gray area. And the older we get, the more we realize that there are indeed several gray areas that we, at the beginning of our relationship, observed to be black and white areas. Also, we both came to realize that many issues were much greater than we originally perceived, which fostered a greater sense of easiness and not needing to resolve every issue or unanswered question in our lives. While this has increased the degree of ambiguity with which we live and forces us to negotiate on many issues that we may not have negotiated on at the beginning of our relationship, it has elicited a much greater and more satisfactory involvement with decision-making processes with both of our lives.
I'm going to stand up because I realize this half can't see me when I'm sitting down. I've asked each one of the panelists, or as they chose, to include both the friendship and conflict and the intimate parts of their relationship, as well as the external roles and how that mixes with church ideas, and they have done so, and I really appreciate that. Let me just share with you some observations from a sociological or research point of view that I've been aware of and have done some thinking about in the last few years. Even though I'm a therapist now, I was for a number of years an instructor of marriage and family relationships at the University of Utah, and so I've kind of keep thinking about all these issues, even though I'm not always dealing with them. To the question, are Mormon marriages changing? Of course, there's yes and no answers. And let me give you the yes answer first, and then I'll give you some of the no answers. And then, of course, as always, we can decide for ourselves. There have, in the sense that we've been changing, we have been changing a lot longer than we think we've been changing. It's a real curious phenomenon that we start to think change occurs when it occurs in the media. But in fact, many changes occur long before that. In 1956, a study was done by a man named Christofferson, and he addressed this question of, are Mormon marriages, in their power structure, are they patriarchal or egalitarian, meaning equal? What's going on with that? And he found very clearly then that even though couples say we have a patriarchal marriage, it was clearly egalitarian. And there was no equivocation on that. What had happened simply is that the patriarchal model keeps getting reinterpreted as patriarchal, even though we become more and more equal. So we essentially have a mixed model marriage within the church. The church rhetoric, if you may notice, over pulpits and in the ensign and so on, also have this mixed model flavor to it. We talk about being husband-headed and having completely equal partnerships. So that we again encounter paradox, and what does that really mean? What I think it really means is that everybody works that out for themselves, and they come to their own particular balance of influence or relationship, and then they try to label it in such a way they can talk about it in sacrament meeting or relief society or priesthood or whatever, all the while really struggling and trying to make sense out of doctrinal, theological, scriptural issues, and trying to balance that. Who's supposed to say what the say is? Who decides who decides? And how to love and how to do all that in loving. And I think there's a tremendously complex mixed model that we're trying to live out. And in the middle of that, some changes are occurring. Here are some other ways that things have changed. Even though we've, for many, many years, 30 years plus now at least, documented by research, have had this mixed model, I think the changes in the last 10 years particularly, maybe a little more, is that we are aware of it. We talk about it now. You know, now that it's appeared in the media nationally, it filters down to our level as different of us read different magazines and it appears at different places in print and so on. And so we talk about it. We're conscious there are choices. We're conscious that other people are talking about it. And I'm hopeful that this panel today increases that consciousness as you are aware from a very personal level how three couples have struggled to and rejoiced even to different levels of awareness about their marriage. So I think the difference really is that we're starting to put the microscope to what has been occurring to us all along. Some other changes, though, are real and discernible and measurable. One is that women are working more, and not just working more, but becoming more career women. And as I said before, I think that makes an incredible difference to a marriage, whether the wife is working and supporting basically the traditional structure of the husband being the primary breadwinner, and she's adding in money for various necessities or for extras or for enrichment or for choice, or whether both of them have career and both see that as really important to the marriage, to their identity, for their mission in life. And I think more and more women are defining their career as central to their mission in life, even from a church or spiritual sense, not just because they need the money. And that change, as it occurs more and more, I think also comes into Mormonism, and it then starts to change the structure of the marriage as couples start talking about that and start sharing it. So I've appreciated Brooke and Jill's insights into that. As they said, even though currently Jill is not working outside and Brooke is, we're committed to the ideal, and that will still be part of the strain of our marriage later.
She thinks she's not working outside. My perception is it's about 25 or 30 hours a week.
The discernible part is that, for instance, over 51% of women in Utah work, and since 70% of Utah is Mormon, a lot of those are Mormon women who are working, it's true that Utah women, more than other women in the nation, do not tend to work outside of the home when their children are preschool age. But once they enter school, tend to go back to work and work as much out of necessity and out of self-definition of this is my work in life. So that is changing. Another thing that is really changing Mormon marriages is divorce. It is true that temple marriages are much more resilient to divorce than civil marriages are, but they still divorce. And the increase in the divorce rate over the last 20 years has affected temple marriages well, and I am one witness to that. As is Brooke. Another thing that happens is that Mormons tend to remarry more quickly. Utahns marry more quickly than some others do in the rest of the nation, and so we have more remarried families. Now, we do not have more remarried families than the rest of the nation particularly. We have more remarried families in Mormonism now than we had 20 years ago, is what I'm trying to say. And that as you struggle to make sense out of that, children grow up in a complex world, and the marriage encounters complexity it would never have encountered otherwise. When Brooke and Jill said that they went into this thinking it would be easy and discovered it was hard, I heartily underlie that. Several researchers say step families or remarried families is the most difficult structure to have in family because you have so many people impinging on it. For instance, my husband has 8 children. I have 3 children. The 3 live with us. The 8 don't live with us. My ex-husband remarried and has had children since then. My children have 15 step-siblings or half-siblings of various ages, which they have different kind of contact or non-contact, but essentially they live in a very complex world and move back and forth between several states yearly, and theirs is a much more fluid family than the family I grew up in, even though I think mine was as large in terms of number of children and cousins and so on. Everybody kind of stayed in the same structural niche throughout my life, and that's not happened for my children. And for the marriage to keep track of children coming and going, making sense of that, what are their roles, dealing with past hurts of past marriages and then trying not to replicate that in a subsequent marriage is all very complex, and it affects Mormon marriage now. It also affects Mormon marriages where that is not occurring. Even in Mormon marriages that are stable, you know someone who has divorced and remarried, or someone who is a single parent and is remaining a single parent, and that affects you if it occurs in your family. Most of the couples also talked about the accelerated society around us and that increasing level of complexity, and I agree with that. I think that it isn't happening on two ways. We not only have a more achievement-oriented society, that performance accounts more and more, and we as Mormons are very good at pulling that into our lives and wanting to achieve all of that, so it really impinges on the marriage. But in the last 15 or 20 years, intimacy and friendship in a marriage has become a new ideal. It's not that it wasn't important before, but again, we're conscious of it. It's written about. You can buy books on marital communication, on conflict resolution, on increasing love after marriage, and you can find 10 to 15 books in the bookstore. You could not find that 15 or 20 years ago. There are workshops you can go to enrich your marriage called Marriage Encounter of various kinds of sorts. And because of that, we have a new expectation. I'll get to this in a moment, but for instance, women do not do any less housework in terms of number of hours per day now than they did in the early 1900s. They do the same number of hours. The difference is, even though we have more labor-saving devices, our expectations have increased tremendously. And so as we have more technology for relationships as such, we can communicate, we can solve conflict, we can really discern ultimate meaning at the bottom of our lives now, all through marriage, any time of the day. I mean, that's possible. That's an expectation that we should do at all of the time. Rather than being flip, I really think in terms of spiritual and emotional growth, that is really important. It's just that it is another expectation requires work. And I think that Brooke is right, that that acceleration and complexity makes it much more difficult. What has not changed in Mormon marriages, let me just briefly say, is that even with all of the changes of work and divorce and increasing pressure and complexity on the family, women still do most of the housework and the parenting, and that is true in Mormon families. Don Herron, in a doctoral dissertation in 1982 or 83 at BYU, investigated several groups of happily married, stable, active Mormon couples with several locations throughout the United States. So it's very comprehensive. And he found that in Mormon marriages that are active, each person tends to spend 20 hours a week doing church work, plus they tend to do their parenting and work and so on. He found that women tend to do most of the housework and the parenting. Mormon men do not do any more parenting per week than U.S. men in general, which is less than 3 hours a week. They do not do any more housework than U.S. men in general, which is even less than 3 hours a week. And that does not change if a woman works. The woman still does most of the housework and the parenting when she works. The husband's role does not change substantially for Mormon men or non-Mormon men if the wife goes to work or has a career. What also tends to happen, and that has not changed, is that once a couple has children, the focus tends to change from the marriage to the children, and from the marriage to the career as it's increasing, and from the marriage to whatever other crisis come in life. After the first child is born, marital communication tends to decrease by 75% from going to the hospital to coming home to the hospital. It happens instantaneously, and it never recovers until the kids leave home for the very last time. One of my colleagues in my work, her last kid got married last week. They had the reception. She wrote us a thank you note, and on the thank you note said, "It went very well. The last one's out of the nest. Yay!" Meaning that they could talk again. And that's true. For marriages that remain intact, then marital intimacy starts to increase again. And there is no reason to believe that Mormon couples are any different than that. There are only two or three variables on which Mormon couples, I think, are substantially different than United States couples overall. One is they tend to have a lower divorce rate. They tend to report a little bit higher happiness on happiness scales, although it's really funny because most couples you will ask on any marital happiness scale will report they are very happy, and yet we still have a high divorce rate. So, you know, we haven't got that one figured out. But even so, they tend to report very high happiness rates and they tend to have more children, which may take away from the marriage to some extent. Other than that, and maybe other two or three other things you can pick out, really we're very much like U.S. couples in general. So when you read in the newspaper, U.S. couples are doing such and such, don't go, oh, well, they're U.S. and we're Mormon, therefore that has nothing to do with us. I would say, no, it probably has a lot to do with us. And if we're not experiencing it now, we may experience it in the next few years. So what has not changed is women in housework, men in parenting, less focus on marriage over time. It is increasingly hard to keep the intimacy and friendship going, even though we have that higher expectation. So for many couples, there is a split between what they really want and what they don't get because the expectations are proliferating. And sometimes even those expectations are proliferating in the church, given that we have more programs for family, more programs for taking care of kids, more programs for, you know, doing this or that. That still requires time. My guess at, rather than saying that the Mormon family is changing or the Mormon marriage is changing, I would say more types are emerging. You know, rather than the professionals nationally in family life education, rather than try to decide how many marriages are changing, have really gone to a model of saying these are the types of marriages that are now present and kind of pulling out of research different kinds of types, and there are all kinds, and so I'm just going to pull out two or three that make sense, I think, from my discussion about power and decision-making in relationships. My sense is that there are probably at least three types of Mormon marriages emerging. One is the traditional marriage that
is still extant. It still receives a lot of credibility. There's still many people who live it, and there's still many people who love it. I think it exists at least in two forms. One is compatible, and one is conflicted. Some don't get along at all, and some do. It seems to be never a big issue in terms of defining whether we get along or not, what kind of form of marriage we choose. You know, we can fight a lot or get along well, but you know, the form is somehow still more important. I think, however, that is becoming less. I think more and more couples are moving what I call into a mixed model marriage. They are determining for themselves what the rules will be about who works, who does housework, how much time they'll spend together, how much, how they'll discipline their children, and all of those kinds of things. But it is also a very confusing model because we don't know the rules, and for people raised in a culture where the church makes up the rules and you follow them, that becomes real confusing. One of the confusion is this right? Is this okay to do? One of those arguments, of course, is around priesthood all the time, and I think priesthood is becoming redefined all the time. Luckily, my perception is that luckily priesthood is being more and more defined as a service, love-oriented function than an administrative, bureaucratic function in the home. I don't necessarily agree with that church-wide in terms of the church bureaucracy, but I do believe that's happening more in Mormon marriages, that it is a function to bless rather than to command. And that's just my perception. 5 of you, or 10 of you, or 20 of you may disagree with me, and that would be fine. I think another small minority are becoming completely democratic, and that there's a full sharing of who decides what, divvying out or even doing all of the work together, both emotional work and practical work. But I think on the two ends, essentially, on the traditional end and the fully democratic end, and they're very small, in the middle we have a whole heap of people who are trying to work out a mixed model marriage. But in my sense, I think that's good, because I think the gospel, like the Constitution, is a broad framework of general principles for us to work out our own lives, and I actually applaud it rather than deny or criticize the change. Thank you. We have 5 or 6 minutes for questions, so if anyone has them. How I would like to work it is that I will just indicate who can stand up and then ask whomever you'd like to, okay? Yes.
My wife and I are just embarking on a prayer in the same occupation. We have children in the home, and I want to give some advice to the women sitting up there. Tell me what to do. That's what my wife is telling me.
Actually, you're the more important one to tell, given current...
I have a response. I'm not female, but I suggest the new Scandinavian model, which is 30 days on, 30 days off. The male does everything for 30 days, and the female is totally free to work and come and go. Then the female does everything for 30 days, and the male is free to come and go. I didn't get the church in Norway, so I'm not sure whether they're using it there, but it seemed like a good one.
What we do know that is that Mormon marriages in other cultures tend to follow that cultural pattern more than they follow Utah cultural patterns. Way in the back, please.
I don't know if you said this to speak to the Mormon people, but they allowed me to. I don't know if you meant that, that's what you're about, going back to work. If you said that facetiously, I agree with it. I'm concerned about that attitude within the church and not change apparently in some instances. Didn't allow me to concern because I think what this often does is pass the platform on someone else to alleviate the personal responsibility to things. It's a rule that needs changing, so we can actually come to the agreement that all people are created equal, certainly equal, but by the time to do that. I wish you could discuss that, if you would, whether you meant that or not. It doesn't allow you to do that.
Who were you talking to about husband?
He said he allowed me to.
He allowed me to what? To...
You grinned when you said
that. No, I mean,
you can't imagine it applies to you, right?
I think I was being facetious, and the point was I had to talk him into the part-time secretarial business in my home. It was not, I was not going outside of the home to work. Sure. But he, I guess ultimately he had to consent to the fact that we purchased the typewriter, which he, you know, at one point it was a vote of no confidence that the clientele would be steady, but finally, you know, relented and then saw what
what I could do.
Does this changing in the church that this allow me to do things that
actually let me answer that. I always think that allow me to do this or allow me to do that is a real cover for what really goes on behind the scenes in the marriage. Some people really may feel that my husband will not allow me to do this, or my wife might not allow me to do that. My experience in working with couples in marriage is that people pretty well go ahead and do what they want to anyway. The conflict comes when they can't agree or work that out in an amicable fashion with each other. Do we determine our success by how we get paid for it or not, is the question.
Well, you may have guessed that's my daughter.
Oh.
One of them. They all have the same complaint. They're concerned that I would equate my success or my successes in life with a monetary value. And which I do not, I don't think I do, but I felt at that point that part of my my effort to do this was to see if I could be of any, I shouldn't say worth, but to see if I could make a contribution financially. And I did. I got us in debt so far, it'll be 100 years before we get it. So, it's just that is a tag that is put on most of us in this country.
I do think that Mormon women are struggling a lot with that issue.
Can I just add that I think Mormon men are too, in a different way. That is, I say that I don't put that kind of value on things. That is, that my identity doesn't depend on what I'm paid for, but I act as if it does. I mean, it's a great theory, and I think our society puts enormous pressure to connect those two. I guess I worry a lot when I see women adopting that construct, which I think has been very destructive to men and still is, even though men aren't as aware of it. And so that worries me a lot. Theory and practice are very different. I was thinking while Leland was talking that he and I have a kind of opposite problem. He was bad on the theory of dialogue in his marriage, but seems to have worked it out very well. I'm very great on the theory. I really believe in dialogue, in fact. But my problem is that most of my dialogues are with myself, and I think I've really neglected that element of marriage.
Thank you very much.